He never received anything but the worst care. He went down one day at Narragansett and was taken to the hospital, but no one ever came to look him over, so he just got up and went home. It wasn't until much later that he learned that he had walked out on a broken hip. After breaking his back in a spill in Maryland in 1942, he was carried to a hospital in a laundry basket. The injury knocked him out of the sport for a year and left him with one leg shorter than the other. A 1945 head injury incurred in a Florida race cost him a handful of teeth and nearly his life. "When I woke up, the parish priest leaned over me and whispered, 'The devil has no stall for you, so here I am,' he told reporters after awakening. 'And I guess I'll be here forever, me and Methuselah.' He nearly was. His brilliant red hair slowly went gray, his blind eye paled, his battered body aged, and still he rode racehorses. He rode alongside kids who hadn't even been born when he first offered a sugar cube to Seabiscuit. But he never let the latest teenaged hotshot get the best of him, shouting, 'No room at the bar!' He would cut off the rail route and make some poor kid go around the long way. He came home at night, and Agnes tended to him. So many phone calls told her of terrible crashes that she came to fear the phone's ring. On some mornings, the back door banged open to reveal a host of muddy racetrackers carrying a bloodied red in from another fall. She prayed for his safety every day, but never complained to him. She understood, as would her children, that her husband would have suffocated in any other life. He was in constant and serious pain, but didn't speak of it. He still carried a rosary and little volumes of poetry in his pocket, and still gave away most of the money he earned. His children grew up knowing to be careful around their father's game leg, which never fattened up to anything much thicker than a broomstick. Pollard wove his books into his children's lives, but did not try to teach them about horses. He never once brought them to the track to see him ride, and didn't tell the stories of his youth. The closest his daughter, Nora, ever came to the races was to comply with his request to paint a cougar on his helmet. By 1955, when he was 46, he couldn't make it any longer. "Maybe I should have heeded the rumble of that distant drum when I was riding high," he once said. "But I never did. Trouble is, you never hear it if you're a racetracker. Horses make too damn much noise." He called David Alexander from across the country to tell him the news. "I'm hanging up my blouse for good," he said. "I wanted you to be the first to know. You can't first past Father Time." "It's about time," said Alexander. When the writer paid tribute to him in a lengthy article in Time, Pollard called him up and sang every verse of, "You made me what I am today, and I hope you're satisfied," then hung up. Pollard wound up sorting mail in a track post office, then working as a valet, cleaning the boots of other riders. His racetrack injuries worsened as he aged, and he slowly became a prisoner in his own body. He struggled as hard as he could against his alcoholism, but never beat it. One day in the waning years of his life, Red Pollard stopped talking. Perhaps it was a physical problem. Perhaps the old raconteur just didn't want to speak anymore. When on rare occasions a reporter turned up to ask about Seabiscuit, Agnes answered the questions, while Red sat by, mute. In 1980, Agnes was hospitalized with cancer. Though only 70, Pollard was suffering from so many physical problems that he could no longer get along without her. His children had no choice but to place him in a nursing home. He knew this ground. The home had been built over the ruins of Narragansett Park. The cougar slipped away one day in 1981, uttering not a word in parting. Agnes was with him when he stopped breathing. His heart kept beating for several minutes, then went still. No cause of death was ever found. It was as if, Nora remembers, he had just worn out his body. Agnes died 2 weeks later. Seabiscuit and Howard grew old together in the slow rhythms of Ridgewood. Howard's hair thinned. Seabiscuit's muddy bay coat darkened. Howard kept the horse with Kayak in a handsome red barn and installed a walking ring that led right up to the door of Howard's house. He hung a sign on the pillared gates to the ranch, out on the Redwood Highway, that read, "Ridgewood, home of Seabiscuit. Visitors welcome." The visitors came. 50,000 over the years, as many as 1,500 at a time. Howard erected a little grandstand by his horse's paddock and ushered the spectators in to watch him. Kayak thrilled the crowds by galloping around his adjacent paddock in all his black splendor. Most of the time, all Seabiscuit did was stretch out on his side, drowsing in the shade of his paddock oak tree. Occasionally, he would raise his head and look the spectators over, then drop off to sleep again. Once in a while, he'd get up and amble over to his admirers, licking their cameras and sticking his tongue out to be scratched. With each spring, the foals came. Howard doted on them as if they were his own children. "They are the finest foals I have ever seen," he said when the first crop came, "and I am not prejudiced when I say this." They all had their father's amiable personality, and most of them had his homely little body, too. Nearly all were homebreds, the products of Howard's moderately bred mares. The ranch was more than 600 miles from the nearest major breeding farm, and few breeders wanted to subject their mares to such a long haul. So Howard used his own mares, pampered and overfed their babies, and sent them into training fat and happy. When the little biscuits reached racing age and went south to the tracks, the public flocked in to see them. Thousands of admirers came out to watch the workouts, and on race days, full houses packed in to cheer for them and for proud old Howard. The owner issued Christmas card photos of Seabiscuit standing with his foals. The cards became hot items across the nation. One racetrack, Chicago's Arlington Park, recreated one in a giant mural. A few of the Seabiscuits could run. Sea Sovereign and Sea Swallow became stakes winners, as did a chip off the old block, a grandson named Sea Orbit, who ran 67 times, winning 22, including a long list of elite stakes races in California. One of Fairnitus's foals, Phantom C, became stakes placed. But most of the Seabiscuits were poor racehorses, and because Howard refused to let them suffer the indignity of running at their ability level in claiming races, few of them won anything on the track. Howard didn't seem to notice. After an advisor talked him into selling an especially slow one, Howard quietly bought him back. "You don't understand," he explained. "This one used to eat sugar cubes out of my hand." Hollywood took the tale of Seabiscuit's life, deleted everything interesting, and made an inexcusably bad movie, The Story of Seabiscuit, starring Shirley Temple. They cast one of Seabiscuit's sons in the title role. When they set up to film the War Admiral match race, they deliberately chose a woefully sluggish horse to play War Admiral. Unfortunately, the Seabiscuit son was even slower. Every time they tried to shoot the race, the colt playing War Admiral beat the colt playing Seabiscuit, no matter how hard the jockeys tried to prevent it. Eventually, they gave up and substituted film of the actual race. Seabiscuit settled well into his retirement. Knowing he needed activity, Howard taught him how to herd cattle. The horse loved it, nipping at the animal's rumps and torturing them as he had once tortured War Admiral in Kayak. Every day the ranch hands rode him out with Pumpkin on a 5-mile jaunt, trotting up and down the California hills, cantering alongside the lake, pausing to graze on the mountain grass. He became very fat, 1,250 pounds, and blissfully happy. Every fall he would pose for family portraits, sometimes with Marcella aboard, and Howard would have the photos printed in huge numbers and mailed to everyone he knew. When the war came, Howard looked into building a bomb shelter for the horse, but eventually gave up the idea. He worked to help the war effort, donating an ambulance to the British Red Cross, which named it Seabiscuit. Howard printed patriotic messages on all the Seabiscuit Christmas cards and mailed Seabiscuit shoes off to bomber pilots as good luck charms. Two bombers were named for the horse, The Navy's Seabiscuit bomber was painted with the horse's smoke-breathing likeness. The Air Force's Seabiscuit, which was shot down off the coast of China in 1944, had the horse's name painted across its nose. As Seabiscuit aged, Howard faded. His heart began to fail him, and his life slowly contracted. Marcella, who adored him to the last, nursed him through his final years. He showered her in flowers and little love notes, written in a wavering hand. He found one last success on the track, this time with the great Noor, winner of the Santa Anita Handicap and conqueror of Triple Crown winner Citation. "Guess you've got another Seabiscuit on your hands," said a reporter after Noor's greatest win. Howard, thin and unsteady, straightened up and raised his chin. "Sir," he said, "there will never be another Seabiscuit." When his heart became too frail for him to endure the thrill of seeing his horses run, Howard came to the track anyway. Sitting in the parking lot and listening to race calls on the radio in his Buick. In what is believed to be the last photograph ever taken of him, he was at the racetrack, standing in the winner's circle. After leaving the track, he would go back to Ridgewood to be near the horses. On beautiful days, he would throw a saddle over Seabiscuit, and together they would walk into the hills to lose themselves in the redwoods. On the morning of May 17, 1947, Marcella met her husband at breakfast and told him his rough little horse was gone, dead of an apparent heart attack, at the relatively youthful age of 14. The one-time bicycle repairman, whose own heart would fail him just 3 years later, was beside himself with grief. "I never dreamed," he said, "the old boy would go so quickly." Someone broke the news to Pollard, who was plugging away on claimers at Suffolk Downs. His mind rolled back over all those years. "It seems only yesterday," he said. Howard had the body carried to a secret site on the ranch. After Seabiscuit was buried, the old owner planted an oak sapling over him. Howard, a vigorously public man, made his last gesture to his horse, a private one. He told only his sons the location of the grave, and let the oak stand as the only marker. Somewhere in the high country that once was Ridgewood, the tree lives on, watching over the bones of Howard's beloved Seabiscuit. This is George Newbern. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Seabiscuit, An American Legend, by Laura Hillenbrand. This program was directed by Tony Huds. Executive producers, Dan Zitt and Dan Musselman. Text copyright, 2001, by Laura Hillenbrand. Production copyright, 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.